Hello, friends. Tired of traditional car dealerships pushing you around for 5 hours just to end up with a payment that's more than you can afford? They're not your friends, but you know who is your BFF? Volkswagen of Boise. They have a non-commission sales team that genuinely cares about your vehicle needs. Not ready to buy today? No pressure. Come back when you're ready, and they'll make the process easy and hassle-free with upfront pricing and a no-haggle philosophy. Volkswagen, engineered to buy easy. For more info, go to volkswagenofboise.com. This is the Boise Bubble Podcast, where we talk all things Treasure Valley. We're your hosts, Shane and Natalie Plummer. Welcome back to the conversation. Welcome back, everybody, to the podcast. I thought that we would start with some introductions, and we need more introductions than normal because today is a special day that I've ditched Natalie. She's staying home. And today I have a special co-host, Taylor Walker.
Hello.
Hello to you. Taylor, besides being a personal friend, thank you for being my friend. Taylor.
Very topical for Betty White's birthday. That was a good.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you for being a friend.
We love Betty White. Mm-hmm. Yeah. she was a hard working gal. But back to you. Taylor, many of you might know her from social media. Taylor, you have a couple of awesome Instagram accounts. What are they?
Taylor Amazing, which has evolved from food to now memes, apparently. That's my thing. And Food with Finn, where I am the chef for my one-year-old son who tries all the foods.
Natalie loves your memes. You are spot on.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Food with Finn is a lot of fun, too.
It is fun.
And I don't want to talk too much about it, but I love the concept. Tell people what the idea of Food with Finn was.
So we had our son try 100 different foods before he turned one. Based around the fact that we didn't want him to just eat mac and cheese for his whole life. So he's had everything from caviar to chicken livers to just the regular apples and all that stuff. So he's eaten more than a lot of people I know.
So I want to follow up later on in like 4 years when he can communicate more and find out if he's a picky eater or if he's open-minded.
We'll keep you posted.
My kids are driving me absolutely crazy. They have a very limited palate. So, and beyond that, you have an interesting history with the Air National Guard, with the Idaho Air National Guard.
Yeah, I'm a former member of the Idaho Air National Guard. I was a photojournalist there. And the cool thing about that job is that I get to document everything that happens at the base. So if people are making sandwiches, I'm taking pictures. If they're jumping out of an airplane, I'm taking pictures and writing stories and sharing those stories on social media. So it's a cool way to be a historian of the base and get to share what's happening out there.
Have you been on an airplane or on a jet?
Well, not on an A-10.
Right.
Right, because there's only one seat. But no, I've been on...
Should I know that? Maybe I should.
Maybe.
I know it now.
I have not flown in an A-10, maybe someday. Mm. But no, I've been on like refueling planes during refueling missions and seen... So you may have seen some of those photos that Natalie shared, but... And I've been on helicopters a lot to take pictures from there.
I love that I have several friends that intimidate me. You kind of intimidate me.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I see some of the things that you've done, and I think, oh, she's done a lot with her life. And she's only like 28. That's, it's awesome.
Yep, only 28.
Anywho, thank you for coming, because I feel like the topic that we wanted to talk about today is, it's really interesting to me. We're going to talk about the Idaho National Guard. And the Guard is kind of this weird thing, I think, in the public image that there are a lot of people that don't really know what's going on with the Guard. You know somebody who works there. You know that they have a little bit of a time commitment doing something outside of work, but you've never really asked what it is that they do. And in getting to know you and your story, I learned so much about what the Guard is and what the Guard does, and it piqued my curiosity, and I thought that that would be awesome for other people to learn.
Absolutely.
So we have a wonderful guest today, General Timothy Donnellan. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. Thanks for having me today.
So I was reading your bio, and there's a lot of titles that you have, and I realize I'm just going to muck it up if I try this. So introduce yourself. Tell us who you are, because you work with the Idaho Air National Guard, but you also are part of the Idaho National Guard, which I had to do a lot of learning about the different branches and how they report up and the structure. You're going to do a better job than I will.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. A lot of times when they have these introductions that come out, I always want to think that they're going to tag on Mother of Dragons at the end of it, because, you know, in the military we have these titles and these positions, and they sound so grandiose. So it's interesting that you say that. Really, in a nutshell, I'm the commander of the Idaho Air National Guard. So everything that happens in the Idaho Air National Guard, I'm responsible for. So all the way down to taking care of our youngest airmen, We got lots of people in between me and that young airman to do that job. But just on the Air National Guard side, that's what my primary job is, readiness for both the state and the federal mission. I work for a two-star general, Major General Michael Garshak, and he is our adjutant general, and he is in charge of both the Air and the Army. So I report directly to him, and he reports directly to the governor, who is our commander-in-chief for the Idaho National Guard.
So the guards both report up through the state, is what you're saying.
So just like everything, when you start talking about the guard, it's like an iceberg. Mm-hmm. So yes, that is true. We in a Title 32 status, which is U.S. Code 32, our chain of command goes to the governor. If we get federalized, because we have two missions, we have a state mission and a federal mission. If we get federalized to do the federal mission, then our chain of command goes directly from the president through active duty Air Force, mm-hmm. or Army, if it's the Army soldiers. So that's why it's a good time to talk about how we're set up. So all of our equipment, people a lot of times can say, well, why do we need A-10s in Idaho Air National Guard? We're not going to go to war with Montana or Wyoming or maybe Canada. No, just kidding. But or California or Washington. So why do we need A-10s in a state guard? Well, that's because the federal government has said, hey, we'll fund this mission. And so we're going to put this mission in Idaho, and there's a federal job to do. But when you're not doing your federal job, we want you to train and be ready to do it. But then the governor will use you as the governor sees fit. Mm. So it really kind of goes back to, and I won't get into a history, I won't go full dad mode on you, but in the history of the National Guard, really started back in 1636 when we were militia, and back when separate colonies of the 13 colonies, but every little town would have their own militia. And in times of trouble, for whatever they would call out to militia. That eventually grew into the Revolutionary War. And then afterwards, the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8, talks about setting up state militias. And so militias fell underneath the auspices of the governor. And then around 1916, there was the National Defense Act that realigned it under the federal system. So why is that important, and why is that critical to the Idaho National Guard, is that we really have two chains of command. It just depends on what status that we're in. Mm. So if we're not doing a federal mission, we'll do our state mission, but we'll still train for our federal mission.
Yeah.
So hopefully that makes sense.
I love interviewing people because I feel like my job is to ask questions that other people want answers to. So it's like an excuse to be the dumb guy and ask the dumb questions. I'm going to ask a lot of dumb questions, which I think that this is great. And as I've been learning more about the Guard, the career path is amazing to me. That's super interesting. Its difference from active duty is interesting to me, too. And the number of people that you employ in the state blew my mind whenever I compared it to other people in the state. So there's a lot to talk about. But let's talk a little bit about the general purpose. You kind of touched on that. There's a federal mission, and then there's other mission too for the state.
Yep.
But big picture, Gowan Base is where you guys are housed, correct?
You bet. So, and that's just the air side. So on the Army side of the National Guard, we're actually in 12 different communities throughout the state in our armories, big presence on the eastern side of the state, and then up in north around Lewiston, we have other armories up there too. So for the National Guard for Idaho, we're all over the state. We just happen to have the Air National Guard is right at Gowan, and that's because we're smaller than our Army counterparts. We're about 1,300 folks on the air side and about 4,400 folks on the Army side. We have some state employees that we have as well. So our total is about 6,600 people in the Idaho National Guard. And interestingly, every couple years we try to do an economic impact study. In the last one in 2020, the Idaho Chamber of Commerce rated the Idaho National Guard the fourth largest employer in the state.
That is a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. It's a big company, but just behind St. Luke's, Walmart, and Micron.
People have no idea about things like this. So I don't want to pepper you with statistics that you don't know, but of these thousands of people, roughly proportioned, how many are full-time, how many are part-time?
That's a good question. Our model in the Guard is to do 25% full-time and 75% part-time.
The majority of them are part-time.
Yes. And that is the value proposition of the Guard. And that's one of the reasons why the Guard has lasted this long and why I could get on the soapbox about well, I probably should a little bit. You as a taxpayer, you're always watching where your money goes. And so in the case of the Guard, you are paying for the same readiness levels on active duty, but you're only paying about a third of the cost because 75% of us are traditional. We have other jobs that we do, and we bring folks in. And on both the Air and the Army side, we are at the same readiness level as the federal forces are, as active duty. So it's kind of an interesting thing to think, well, if only 25% of you are full-time, how do you keep all of you trained at all times to be as equally ready? And through a lot of dedication, a lot of discipline, in every day paying attention, making sure that what we're doing counts.
The scheduling alone blows my mind. I mean, with so many part-time people having to keep the lights on, keep everything moving, keep everything ready, but you're dealing with limited capacity people, how on earth do you tackle something like that?
Well, you got to have the discipline to do it. There's a lot of, the good idea fairy is always dropping by and ringing the doorbell because it's like, hey, we have all these highly capable people and the people on the Guard that we have are just phenomenal. I'm blown away every day by the folks we're having, and especially our young folks that are coming in, just starting, just amazing individuals that are so talented and really driven to a life of service. So how do you take care of that? Because that really is something you've got to not abuse. Mm-hmm. And so we work really hard at when that good idea fairy comes in and says, hey, the Guard can do this. Our Adjutant General is very aware and says, well, we got to be careful because remember, these folks are out here just a handful of days a month, and we've got to make sure they train to their readiness mission.
I feel like it's the whole idea of the Guard is something that most of us don't know about, but we're kind of too embarrassed to say it. I was telling Taylor before we started, I used to work with a guy that was in the Guard, and he was getting deployed, and all of a sudden he's deployed, but we were sitting in this leadership meeting talking about, oh yeah, well, so-and-so is going to be gone for several months, and but then we are just like, okay, well, he's going to be gone. Let's just plan on it. It was like an excused absence, but nobody really wanted to say, what are you doing? Like, is that a normal thing to get deployed that often? Nobody knew, but nobody really asked too many questions. Did you get peppered with a lot of questions when you joined the Guard, Taylor?
Yeah, I was always really forthright about what I was doing and where I would be and what my job was, because my job in particular was very visual, so it was easy for me to tell the story of what I was doing. But I think the fact that we have people in our community that are working part-time and then they have their full-time jobs, I think that's one of the advantages that the Guard has in terms of scheduling. Because in addition to people who are new, and when we say new, that might be like the 18, 19, 20-year-old who's just kind of like trying to figure out what they're doing. We also have these people who have these really deep career paths that they have already taken, and they're also dedicating time to the Guard. So they're coming to the table with a lot of time management skills already in place. They're coming to the table with a lot of ideas in place, a lot of experience. And so in many ways, that makes it easier for us to jumpstart the work that we're doing, because if we have someone who is in the construction industry, and maybe they've been in the construction industry for a decade, and they also work as a civil engineer, well, now they're combining their two lives. And as a result, those two different jobs are enriched because of those experiences.
Yeah, that's really why a lot of people say, hey, why do we care about having a Guard in a community? And I think it's a good question, but I could use Taylor as an example. Yes, she went into public affairs and she took pictures, but the other skill sets that she's not talking about that she got in the military, she's the kind of person you want to have as your next door neighbor. So Taylor did self-aid buddy care. She did fire training. She did chemical warfare training, which talks a lot about different things that can render you unconscious if you're not careful, how to take care of yourself in a crisis. And we stressed Taylor, and she learned a lot of things about herself. So when I say, who do I want to have as my neighbor? I want people like Taylor as my neighbor, because if my house is burning down, I want someone that is going to be calm, cool, under pressure while I'm losing my mind.
Chemical warfare training?
Yeah, we all go through it.
Yep.
And that's something that's so unique about the Guard, and I've told you this a few different times, is that we've got 6,000-plus individuals in the community, and we often don't realize that we have the benefits, of having them as our friends and neighbors because of the trainings that they go through and because of their experiences. And people often don't even realize what that means, or they don't realize that, hey, this guy that's just gone 1 week in a month, the skills that he's getting are beneficial to our entire community.
Hmm. So, General, you talked a little bit about the reasons for joining the Guard, and that's one of the things that I'd like to talk about in our conversations. Taylor, you mentioned it several times, but why are people typically, why would someone join the Guard as opposed to going into full-time enlistment?
Yeah, good question. So the first thing is anybody that joins the military doesn't go in the military to make a lot of money. So that's an important distinction, because you go into the military, or you go into government service, or you go work for the Forest Service, or any of those types of agencies, you go in because you're looking to do something that's mm-hmm. bigger than yourself. So whether it's active duty, Guard, BLM, Forest Service, that's the first thing. So you're going to get this kind of this person that, maybe one day wakes up and says, hey, I want to do something kind of bigger than me. So then you drill down from that, and for someone that wants to go active duty versus Guard, a lot of folks don't want to leave Boise. Shocker. So mm-hmm. the whole reason for your podcast is what a great place this is to live, right? And so they say, how can I have a job, I have my family, I want to stay here, but I still want to do something like the military and go see the world. So the Guard is a perfect option for that. So if you go active duty, you go down to, you know, go to MEPS, you'll take your physical, and then they'll put you on a bus. You'll go to basic training, and then you're going to go somewhere in the world.
Yeah.
You don't know.
No control.
And you might not even know what your job is.
You may not know what your job is.
You don't know what your job is when you do it that way.
So a lot of courage for those folks. But for our Guard folks, a lot of courage as well, because they go to MEPS, which is the Medical Processing Center, and then they talk to recruiters, and they'll know what they're going to get into, hopefully. Most of our airmen and soldiers know what career field they're going to go into. Then they'll go to the exact same training the active duty folks went to. But then when they're done with that training, they'll come back to Idaho, and then they'll do that skill set in Idaho. They'll do that for a year, maybe a couple years, and then they go into what we call traditional status, where they'll be part-time. So then they go back to those lives they had, but yet they still have this cool, amazing thing that they learn how to do, and they'll do as part of their federal and state mission.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the requirements. Is there an age limit for entry into the Guard?
I think it's 36. That's a good question, but it's kind of up there. But yeah, about, I think 36 years old is the latest that we'll take them. But that changes based on the needs of the military. So if we don't get a lot of folks that are coming in, that age can go up. Or if we have too many folks, it can go down.
So what's the general term of service? Taylor, how long did you serve?
Well, my service was shorter. I had a baby and left as a result of that, just because of my personal situation. But I think it depends on the job, yep. doesn't it?
What you're going to be. So if you're going in as an enlisted member, like Taylor was, you sign about a 4-year enlistment. It can go up to a 6-year enlistment. So you'll do an enlistment. At the end of your enlistment, it's just a contract with the U.S. government. Say, hey, my contract is good. And then I'm just going to walk, or I'm going to re-enlist and re-up my contract. If you go in as an officer, you have a commission with the U.S. military, and all branches of the service have officers. And that's a little bit different, because you're commissioned by the President of the United States to be an officer. So officers don't serve enlistments, mm-hmm. but they can say, hey, I would like to tender resignation in my commission, and then they leave. So typically it's 4 to 6 for our enlisted folks for our first term enlistment, and it's kind of open-ended for officers.
Okay. But on the Guard side, same thing.
Yep. Exact same thing. It's just that now on the Guard side, we don't have folks deploying all over the world or living all over the world on a regular basis. So we'll still, that federal mission can take you anywhere. So in my case, I joined the Guard in 2002, and we had a big family, all of a sudden got bigger. We talked a little bit about that. We thought we were going to have 2 kids, and we actually had 4.
Oh.
So yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Triplets.
Yeah, I had a full head of hair like you when they first came.
Right.
But I wanted to slow things down a little bit, and so I said, hey, I'll join the Guard, still get to serve my country, but I gotta pull the throttles back a little bit. And then 8 months later, we were in Iraq for Iraqi freedom. So we said, hey, the slowing down piece didn't work at all, but I was very proud to be a part of that effort. And then ever since then, for the last like 20 years, it's just been deployment after deployment for both the Army and the Air National Guard.
You've been busy.
Very busy, but very rewarding. And all of our folks feel very rewarded for that. So what I thought I was getting into wasn't what I was getting into. It was better. But it just lasted. And some folks stay, some folks don't. They have the option.
Yeah, you've dedicated your life to this thing, and we're many of the people that we're talking about, they are truly part-time, and this is not 100% of what they do, but they do it for a limited amount of time. Tell me a little bit more about the time commitment. When someone is in the Guard, you often hear about the weekends, that they have 1 weekend a month, and then there are some other time requirements. Spell that out for us.
So it's funny, Taylor could do a good job of that too, but our advertising thing says, hey, 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks a year. I don't think that's how it worked out, did it, Taylor?
No, it doesn't. It really, I don't want to overcomplicate it. It really goes back to, it depends on your job. It depends on the need of the shop that you're in or the job that you're in. And it kind of depends on what amount of time you have available and the needs of the mission. And so that time commitment can vary greatly. I think it starts with that 1 weekend a month. But if you have more time to give, the Guard will take that time if you are happy to, you know, put it out there. They are always welcome to have more helpers. And so, and one thing that about the Guard, I'm going to back up a little bit because you were talking about why would people want to join the Guard versus active duty? I think some of that flexibility is another reason. That's why it made sense for our family, is you can have those conversations with your superiors about, hey, I need more time or I need less time. And so it's really a flex thing. I don't think there's a hard and fast answer to that because it depends on what you're doing and it depends on your personal situation.
I love the idea of flexibility. Although it does kind of raise some questions in my mind. I try to put myself in the seat of the person who is going back a weekend a month or 2 weeks a year or whatever that frequency ends up being. Feels like it would be hard to switch back and forth from the civilian lifestyle and managing their job and then all of a sudden plugging in for a weekend and being expected to produce whenever you hit the ground out there. It feels like a psychological challenge.
I think you would be surprised. Like I mentioned before, we have a lot of folks who do similar jobs as a civilian that they do in the Guard. So in many ways, they're just kind of like changing the clothes that they're wearing and, you know, reporting to different people. But also, I think that there is an element of fun to drill weekends. That's what we call them, drill weekends, when we're working that 1 weekend a month. Because you're going in, it's this faster pace, you're practicing your job. And so you don't have a lot of time to think about, how is my brain switching over from this? You're in it and you're going. And that's kind of the culture and you're used to that. Yeah. So I think that it doesn't take much to make that switch. But there are a lot of jobs in the Guard. And I think that's one thing I was thinking about. You know, you said pull the throttle back and you didn't talk much about what your jobs have been, but General Donald was a pilot. And I think people who don't know much about the Guard tend to think that we are all pilots. I remember when I first joined the Guard, people would say, oh, you fly planes. No, there's a lot more that goes into the Guard than flying a plane. There are so many different jobs. And I think that that's a key element that people don't realize. And those different jobs are what create the flexibility and the breadth of experience and the different career paths you can take within the Guard.
Are the pilots full-time or part-time? Or do you have a mix of both?
Same mix. So we shoot for about 30 or 25-75 mix. But it's interesting. I got to talk about Taylor for a second. I remember the first time I met Taylor. Remember that?
I do remember that. Yes. Yeah. He's one of the reasons why I decided to keep dating Kyle.
Tell me more.
Yeah. So I was one of Kyle's pilots. I like to say that. He wasn't my crew chief. I was his pilot. Mm-hmm. And so I stepped out to the airplane one day and Kyle's out there. And I say hi and there's this girl with him. And I said, well, hey, Kyle, who's this? Because everyone else is in uniform except for Taylor. So he said, well, this is my girlfriend, Taylor. So we put you on the headsets, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we got a chance to start the airplane up and taxi. And so Kyle and I are talking, and Taylor got to listen to that. So when she had questions, she said, hey, here's the switch I'm flipping now. Here's what I'm doing. So she got to be right underneath an A-10 while we cranked it up and taxied it out for a mission.
That's a cool
so
date.
Pretty exciting.
Yeah. So then I was like, wow, he's so cool. I'm going to keep dating him.
Yeah. And Kyle's pretty cool.
So thanks for that.
Yeah. And Kyle's welcome too.
Yeah.
So when people think of Gowan, they obviously think of the A-10s, and we know that that's a component of what the mission is, but how much of what you're doing is centralized around keeping this aircraft battle ready?
So the main effort on the air side is the A-10. So like Taylor said, there's a lot of jobs that go into supporting that. So if you look at Gowan Field, and both on the Army National Guard and the Air National Guard, we're like a city out there. We've got engineers that keep our facilities running. We've got cooks that feed us on the weekends. We have folks that pay us. We have security that protect us. We have firefighters that also will protect us. We have maintenance. Our biggest unit is our maintenance unit, and they work on the airplanes, and then we have our operations unit that fly them. We also have a cyber operations squadron that does all the cool cyber stuff. And then we've got an air support operations squadron, which is what we call our joint terminal attack controllers that actually guide in weapons for the Army ground control commander. So in addition to those three operational units, the majority of the force out there is to support those missions.
So when you say a lot of jobs, I mean, are we talking dozen jobs, couple dozen jobs, 100 jobs? It feels like a lot of things that have to happen to keep that place going.
Sure, and you could talk about a public affairs specialist with what Taylor was. Well, we've got different subsets within that. So you can run cameras, you can write stories. We tend to have them do all of them. Mm-hmm. Maintenance is another good example. You could be a maintainer, but maybe you work in the metals fab shop where you're actually making parts for the A-10, or you're a crew chief where you're launching an A-10 and fixing it in between goes. So even a job would have two or three subsets of it that have specialties. So there's a lot out there. I don't even know the number.
I couldn't say the number either. But one thing about all of these different jobs that are out there, too, is many of these jobs have different ways that we connect to the community. So medical is out there. And there's a lot of folks in our medical unit that are also in medical jobs as civilians. But that, I think, is a great example that we've seen recently where we see members of the Guard that are out during the pandemic helping with that as needed, or the Air Support Operations Squadron that he was discussing. We refer to them as ASOS. They do all kinds of joint training with people throughout the state for search and rescue, and they do avalanche training and all kinds of things. And they are there in addition to their federal mission. They're there to help in the event that the state needs that help. Like, I want to say, correct me if I'm wrong, I think there were like some floods in Weezer a while back, and I think that Idaho Guard helped get people out of that from the flooded areas. That was, I want to say, a few years ago. I could be.
Well, there was a dam that broke years ago, but really just recently was the COVID task force. Mm. And a lot of the pictures that you saw as we were, our frontline workers, of our healthcare workers, were getting overwhelmed, and the hospital said, hey, we got to pull these people in and treat patients. We actually responded. Over 400 guardsmen have deployed to support COVID-19 in the last year. We started that back in January of 2021, and it's been just constant the whole time. So that's been significant. Search and rescue is what the ASOS is working on. This year is kind of neat. In 2021, we did our first ever wildland firefighting where we were on the line fighting fires. So we had soldiers and airmen actually trained to get their red card, and were actually fighting fires. Typically, we were directing traffic and doing roadblocks to keep people from getting hurt and doing evacuations, but this year we actually got on the line, and we're going to do more of that. So
it seems like firefighting could be something that would keep the Guard busy full time. That's every year we're dealing with that.
Absolutely. Mm. So flood, fire, earthquakes. We're on a big fault line here in Idaho. Thankfully, none of us have seen that yet, but we've got a lot of capabilities where we could use that. And then obviously medical is a big piece of our operation too.
And those are all just examples of how the person who's working in the cube next to you or living in the house up the street might also be the person who is giving up their 1 weekend a month to train to do something maybe overseas, but also maybe like in the mountains here to protect you at your house. So it all kind of is together like that.
I went to church with an older gentleman that was in the Air Guard, and he told some very fascinating, heavily redacted stories about some awesome aircraft that he was working on through the years. But during his day job, he had a furniture shop, and he refinished furniture. And the way that he talked about what he did with aircraft, I thought, that is a full-time career. And this guy's managing a business on the side and raising a family. That's a busy guy.
Oh, yeah. And you mentioned employers, too. Employers are our unsung heroes of the Guard. Because just like you said, no one questioned. Here in Idaho, we have such tremendous support in the military, both active duty at Mountain Home and in the Guard at all over the state. But it's our employers that support guardsmen by supporting their deployments and their USERRA rights with that. But it's really hiring a guardsman, because nothing forces an employer to hire a guardsman. Because they know when they're getting a guardsman, this person is going to deploy. But it's pretty awesome because we have never had any questions when we have deployed. In the last 20 years that I've been here, we've done a lot of deployments. both state and federal, and we always get support. So our employers really are phenomenal here in Idaho.
I'm really encouraged to hear that, because it was always a question to me to think, well, how do I as a guardsman go into an employer and say, hey, I'm looking for this job, but I have all these extracurricular obligations that I have to manage also, and how do I sell that? But to hear that you don't have to sell it much, that's great. My previous employer, 100% supportive. It was amazing to see. They were just, they just didn't question. They think,
Of it from the employer's point of view. They're hiring someone who has had very specific additional training that makes them probably better at managing their time. It makes them really creative when working with teams and problem solving. It makes them just like, it just brings a different perspective to the table. So it's a huge advantage for an employer to hire a guardsman. So it's not like they're sticking their neck out for nothing.
Yeah. Well, it's like we talked about, who do you want for your neighbor? The same argument. Who would you want for your employee? Someone who's going to race into the building to pull people out if it's on fire, or someone who's going to say, hey, not me, I'm out. They run the other way.
Yeah.
Your guardsmen are going to run into the building to save people.
I can't think of a single performance issue that I've ever had with somebody that's been in the guard, now that I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, it's awesome. I'd be surprised if you could think of one. We don't have very many out there.
So one thing I will say too, in addition to the guardsmen who are employed by corporations and whatnot here in town, I think the entrepreneurial spirit on the base is huge as well. I know so many guardsmen who run their own businesses, and they have these skills to be leaders and to manage a team, and they put that to use for themselves as well. Even in the public affairs shop, I think everybody that I worked with, we all had our own side gigs. So it's, you learn a lot of skills in the guard that you can really apply to grow other areas of your life.
So going back to jobs, in career pathing, you said that whenever they sign up, that they have a decent idea after going through the recruiting process where they're going to, which shop or which job they're going to be performing. Is there flexibility in changing what you do? Because it sounds like there's a lot of opportunities, a lot of jobs. Yeah. Is it easy to transfer from one shop to the other, or to earn or to learn different skill sets?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it depends on availability of that job they want to go into. And I think a lot of it also is we ask our airmen, we invest in them in training. So especially for our enlisted airmen that go through their first enlistment, whether it's 4 to 6 years, depending on what they sign on for, we do ask them to stay in that job during that time, because a lot of those training can be a year long by the time you go through basic training into a tech school.
Yeah.
So we do ask airmen, hey, for your first enlistment, we want you to stay here. But after that, we encourage them to look for other opportunities to grow. For myself, I was a pilot for the longest time, then had the opportunity to go into the ASOS. I became an officer in the Air Support Operations Squadron, but it was the greatest job ever, because one day I would fly airplanes, and the next day I'm out on the ground in a Humvee in a body armor and a helmet on a radio calling in airstrikes. And it was just an awesome way to be, but that's hard to do in other professions. In the Guard, we encourage folks to grow out and branch out. Mm-hmm.
And there are, this is a small group and kind of a niche example, but there are some people who are out there full-time, and their full-time job is different from their one weekend a month job. So they kind of get the best of both worlds too.
Wow.
Yeah. And you see that more on the Army side. We try to line them up for full-time and traditional, but a lot of our Army soldiers, they'll have one job they do during the week full-time, and then on the drill weekends, they'll do a separate one. So, it's pretty neat.
So you had mentioned training. I'm a sucker for learning about training. With so many jobs that are happening on that base, it feels like the training would be very specialized. Do you do all of that training in-house, or is it outsourced?
So the skill sets, the basic skill sets. So for Taylor, when she went to school, she went to public affairs school. And that was that Keesler?
No, it was Fort Meade.
Fort Meade. Mm-hmm. Oh, so that's a good place to go.
Yeah, it was awesome.
So she went to Fort Meade to learn that specific skill. And the Air Force would call it Air Force Specialty Code, AFSC, and the Army they call it MOS, Military Operations Specialty, I think is what that means. it sounds right, right? And so you'll go to that school after your basic training, and then when you have that skill set, you come back. And then when they're here in Gowan, we do operational readiness training. So we'll teach folks, chemical warfare. They get exposed to it at basic training, but then we actually teach them how to do it. No, we don't actually gas folks. Mm-hmm. You see that in movies with throwing tear gas. We don't do that. But we do teach folks how to put it on, and we have people that are emergency management specialists. We'll go around and make sure they're wearing it correctly. And then we do exercises where we actually will throw an alarm up on our giant voice, and then everybody's expected to put their chemical warfare gear on and do their job in their chemical warfare gear.
I think this is an important thing to mention is when we do our training here, I think there's an assumption, and we were talking about this earlier. If I were to say I'm going out to drill this weekend, people think I'm running around a track with a sandbag for 2 days.
Yeah.
And that is not what we're doing. We're doing our job, the same job that we would be doing if we are deployed, to practice it and get better at it. And physical readiness is part of that, but it's not the whole weekend. It's not the whole thing that we're doing.
Yeah, that's one of the hard things I would say is that we have a physical readiness requirement, but it's almost too busy to allow folks to go on drill weekend and go work out for 2 hours. So that's an example of how we ask guardsmen to do more, is that we expect folks to do that during the whole month when we don't see them. And then when they show up, we test them. But that's an example of a requirement that a guardsman will do, but they don't get paid to do it.
Yeah.
So all you employers out there in the Treasure Valley who have guardsmen and you're bringing in donuts, stop. Don't do it.
That's right.
Don't do it.
We're begging you. Yeah. Stop. Bring in vegetables.
Taylor, you said that you went to your specialized school at Fort Meade. Is that what you said? How many of these specialized schools does the military have for these different skill sets?
Oh, wow. I mean, it is probably close to the number of jobs. They might be in the same places, but they're going to be going through different classes. And it will also, like General Donnellan said earlier, whether you're in the Guard or you're active duty, you're going to be going to the same school. So you're all learning the same stuff. In some cases, like for me in public affairs, I was actually in a school with other branches of the military as well and learning those same things. But it's a lot.
If Natalie were here, her eyes would be rolling because she's like, Shane, you're geeking out. I do a decent amount of training for my job, and creating training programs is a lot of work.
Oh, yeah.
And to think of how many programs the military has created and perfected and refined, and so that it's just consistently getting you the output that you are going for, I don't know, something about that really impresses me. That's pretty cool for so many different jobs, too.
Oh, yeah. I think it's important to note, too, that we don't have guard training schools like that. Mm-hmm. We go into the big active duty military to get trained, then we come back and do our job in the guard. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So like for a pilot, if I had started out in the guard, and I did 10 years on active duty and then joined the guard. But if I started out in the guard, which you can do, I'd go to active duty pilot training. Well, first I'd go to officer training school, called Total Force Officer Training, TFOT, and in Montgomery, Alabama, and then I'd go to pilot training. That's all active duty. And then I come back after I'm qualified in my airframe, which for Idaho is the A-10.
Right.
So we don't have guard training schools per se for the entry level positions. They're all active duty. So we just go on active duty for that time. Does that make sense?
Yeah. For me.
I think that's one of, just to kind of feed your training geekiness, that's one of the reasons for me why I joined the Guard, was because I knew that I liked to write. I kind of wanted to learn a little bit more about photography. I knew that I was good at public affairs and I wanted to join the Guard, but I knew also that I would get this very elite training that I could then bring back. And, you know, frankly, if my resume says public affairs for the Idaho Air National Guard, that looks pretty good.
Yeah.
So that was a good reason for me to join as well. And I think the importance of the things that we're talking about too is just the breadth of those jobs. People don't realize that they can join the Guard and they don't have to be a pilot. They don't have to be like standing at the gate. There's so many jobs that they can do, and they get this elite training that's going to help further their careers and further opportunities for them down the road.
Yeah. And this is kind of cool too. Taylor can come back. So she left, and she left on good terms. but if you leave on good terms with an honorable discharge, which she did, then we want her to come back. So someday maybe her life will, the kids will be in school, and she'll say, you know what, kind of missed the Guard. I want to go back into the Guard. We'd take her back in a heartbeat.
You're just painting a picture of flexibility that I did not understand about the military. The military seems to come with a certain perception of rigidity. This is the way that we've always done it. We do it this way and follow the program. But I don't know. It seems like there's a lot of
flexibility. Some of that.
Yeah, there is some of that. But I think that that is one reason why I feel like the Guard fits in so well with the city of Boise, is because when you think of Boise, you think of this community, and you talk about it all the time on your podcast. There's all these different parts of the community and all these different groups, and the Guard is such a community and so ingrained in Boise and so ingrained in the Treasure Valley and in our state, and people don't realize that. And I think part of being able to kind of spiderweb throughout the state is having some of that flexibility and being able to kind of assimilate. And we do it well.
Well, another good example of that is we do recruiting. So one of my jobs as a commander of Idaho Air National Guard is recruiting. So I pay attention to how many recruits we get, what we're doing per year. We have amazing recruiters on both sides of the house, but our Air National Guard recruiters are phenomenal. And so those report directly to me. So my culture that we have in the Guard, not mine, but our culture that we have is critical, because if your culture is bad, people leave, mm-hmm. and they leave in droves and you don't get them back. So we want to be flexible, because I want Taylor to come back. She's a part of our family, and she didn't leave. She just said, hey, I got to take a break here and have my family. But recruiting is direct responsibility of people like me in the Guard. Active duty, they don't worry about recruiting. They have a whole recruiting service that they feed that machine. So a unit commander on active duty is not as worried about recruiting. So it's a big deal for us.
Now you're really speaking my language into this idea of retention.
Yes.
Of tracking your numbers of this. Your people can leave if they so choose. So you have a certain obligation to try to incentivize them to be there. So I like what you said about what they sell. And I love that recruiting reports directly up through you at your level.
Yes.
Just shows how important that is. How do you, when you're talking to new recruits, how do you explain or articulate the culture? And I ask because once they come on board, if what they see is very different from what they heard during that process, that is a strike against you, and the clock is ticking before they say, all right, when's my enlistment done? I got to get out. But how do you describe the culture?
That's a good one. There's obviously reality in my perception and what I want to accomplish. One thing I do want to clarify, though, before we go too much into that one, is we have to be careful about letting people go when they want to go.
Sure.
So that's a tough one, because the United States government puts a lot of money in the training folks. So if an airman comes up and says, hey, I just want to leave. I dipped my big toe in and I didn't like the water. I want out. And they do that with 3 years left in their enlistment. Then we're going to sit down with that airman or soldier and say, okay, here's the deal. We want you to stay.
We invested.
Invested.
You made an obligation for this term.
Yep.
Stay for the term.
So we're going to talk to you about staying in because you signed this contract with the U.S. government and the state of Idaho.
Right.
So that we do have those conversations, and our intent is to keep our airmen. It doesn't always happen, but for the most part, we do. So the culture, what makes our culture attractive? Well, I tell you, we have a culture of accountability, and that word may not seem like it's an attractive thing to people. Like, well, I don't want to go someplace where I'm held accountable all the time. But there is a reward in accountability. Because it's a simple life, right? I always say, hey, live a simple life. Show up, know what is asked of you, do a good job, and you will live a simple life. It's not confusing. So I think we have a strong culture of accountability. We have a strong culture of taking care of our airmen and soldiers. And what does that mean? That means that an airman walks into your office and they're upset about something in their life. We don't just say, hey, I don't have time for this. Get back on the assembly line. What we do say is, hey, sit down. Let's have a conversation. We do that at the supervisor level. We do it at our first sergeant level, whose job is to watch those things in units. We do it at our chief level, which is our senior enlisted rank, and we do it at our commander level. And we train all those folks that, hey, when your airman comes to you with a problem, ask them what's happening. Get involved with them. So we have that culture. The other culture we have is we take care of one another. We don't tolerate bad behavior. And what is bad behavior? We don't tolerate sexual assaults. If you're a person that's going to come in and sexual assault a soldier or an airman, then we are going to hammer you to the fullest extent of military law and civilian law. So we just don't tolerate that. And I think that's good because people need to feel safe where they work.
Right.
So, but it's not a safe business. The military can be a dangerous business. So the other culture we have is we're going to train you how to do your job. And I owe you that. So as a commander, I owe any airman that comes in to say, I'm going to throw every investment I can to make sure you know how to do your job. Because someday it may be in a dangerous place, whether it's for a state mission or a federal mission, and you can know your job. And that goes back to the kind of the discipline and the rigidness of the military that we talked about. I tell you, just personally, I remember launching the first night of Iraqi freedom, and it was back in 2003 on March 19th. And I was nervous, first time I'd been in combat, but all that training had paid off. So there were some automatic things that happened that allowed me to focus on what my task was. And just about every other airman felt that. And when you ask a soldier or an airman or a sailor or a Marine, they're always going to fall back. My training is what I was able to fall back on. So training is a huge part of our culture, which is why when we first started, I said my primary job is readiness, is to make sure that our airmen have the equipment, the training, and the resources they need to do a good job when it counts.
Mm. Shane, I would say, too, that the fact that the general's here right now doing this podcast is really exemplary of the culture, because I was an airman out at the base, and he remembers me. He knows me. He knows about my family, and I'm comfortable to reach out to the guy who's at the top of the Idaho Air National Guard to say, hey, you want to come sit on a couch and do a podcast? I think that that speaks volumes of the culture, and I will say that among his peers, and whether it's other chiefs or other commanders that are throughout the Guard, they know their people, and they know their people's people. They know my husband, and they know his story, and they know my story, and they know just people that they come in contact with, and they remember. And I think that that's such a big part of the familial feel that's out at the Guard, is that they really do care about the people around them enough to just hold those stories close to them and build those relationships and build that rapport.
Mm. And it's fun.
It is really fun.
It's a lot of fun.
It is fun. We do cool stuff.
What's the most fun part about your job, General?
Well, it's going to sound trite, but it's true. It's the people. It is the excitement and the thrill on people's faces when they're challenged. We've got an exercise coming up in February. And when people are working hard and they feel like they have done something with purpose, the look on their face, it's this weird glow that people have when they feel like they are doing something that's bigger than themselves. And I have grown into that. If you had asked me 20 years ago, what's the best part of your job? Oh, it's putting that airplane upside down. It's rolling in, it's strafing. Ah, it's great. But I have matured as a human being, and now I appreciate the smiles on faces, and I appreciate the sweat on the brow. Mm. I appreciate when I have it, and I appreciate sharing that with my fellow airmen and soldiers.
So I'm starting to look at the Guard as a business and a culture and a service provider as well. But just like any business, I mean, every business has struggles, and they've got issues that they deal with. Some companies deal with culture issues, some deal with performance issues. What are some of your struggles as a Guard, as an entity? What are you guys trying to fix or trying to overcome?
Yeah, that's a good one. I think the biggest struggle we have right now is stability. So right now, if folks are on the news and are watching what's happening with the defense budget, it's an interesting conversation because we're in a period now where everything is so expensive. And the U.S. military is no different. So what's happening in Congress and with the Pentagon now is they're trying to figure, hey, how are we going to get to modernizing our force, become the force we need to do, and then do that within our budget? So why is that a struggle that we have here in Idaho? Well, we fly an older airplane on the air side. On the Army side, we're doing pretty good. We've updated our Abrams tanks, and we're updating our equipment, modernizing. And the way the Army is restructuring is actually working out pretty good. But we did lose our Apaches fairly recently, and we got a great Black Hawk squadron out there. We also fly C-12s, and we also fly Lakotas, but we traded in that airframe. For the A-10, we don't really have a replacement for yet. So that's a problem, because my youngest airman, our youngest airman, when I walk around and I talk to them at drill, the question I consistently get is, sir, are we going to keep flying the A-10s? Now, you're talking about a 19-year-old right out of college that may not even be working on A-10s, maybe in our medical group or a firefighter or a security forces member, one of our defenders. And their question is, are we going to keep flying A-10? So they want a career, and they want to be in a stable force.
Well, so you just painted a picture of a structure of jobs that, true, they do funnel up to this one piece of equipment, but if that piece of equipment goes, then all of the downstream jobs or the career path that that young person is thinking about, he's probably thinking, yeah, what do I do for the next 8 years if the purpose of my being out here is all of a sudden gone? Yep. What am I doing?
Yeah. So the good news is I think we've got an amazing story to tell here in Idaho. I believe we have the support of the Air National Guard and the Air Force, but we got to keep sending that message. And the Air Force is getting smaller, and with the Air Force getting smaller, so is the Guard. So here's the interesting statistics. In Desert Storm, there were over 135 fighter squadrons. I'm just using fighter squadrons as an example of the size that we used to be. But there were over 135 fighter squadrons at the beginning of Desert Storm in 1990. We're down to 55 right now. So that's how much the military has grown, has shrunk. The military is the smallest it's been since before World War II. A lot of folks are like, wait a minute, I thought we used to have a bunch of folks in the military and their ideas. We have this huge, massive force. Well, we don't. And that's because we wanted to win the Cold War, right? When you win a war, you want to get some kind of peace dividend from it. And that didn't really happen because we got into Iraqi freedom, we got enduring freedom, and it turned into these rolling conflicts. But we didn't invest as much in modernization as we should have. So now we're at this time where we have to modernize our military for these other threats that are popping up, big threats, potentially. And so how do we do that? And I think that's the challenge that we all have to work through. But there are places like Idaho that are amazing places to do our mission. The terrain here is absolutely fine. You go up north and it looks like Afghanistan. You go through down south and it looks like Iraq in the desert. It's just a phenomenal place to train. We got some of the biggest airspace in the entire country, 11,000 square miles just south of Mountain Home and south of the Snake. So we have all of this capability. And that's one of my big pieces of my job. My biggest challenge is to make sure the Air Force knows that. And when they base airplanes, and if Congress decides to allow the Air Force to retire the A-10, then I have got to have done my job. And General Garshak, our adjutant general, is big about this, and the governor is too, that we've told the Air Force, this is where you need to keep fighters, because this is the place to fly them.
Something about the unique terrain is something that came up in our conversation, Taylor. I hadn't thought about the similarity in the land here compared to what we're fighting overseas. Is it that similar? Maybe I need to be more geographically educated.
Well, look at Mount Bora. How high is Mount Bora? And you fly around some of those things. And I've flown around the peaks in northeastern Afghanistan on the edge of the border with Pakistan. And while it's not quite that high, it's still pretty high. And that's pretty good. But it's not just with the war we just fought or the conflict we just got out of. It's what's next. Yeah, the only thing that Idaho doesn't have is a large body of water, which is, we talk about some threats that are out there that are on the edge of the water, but we can get to those places for that one mission set. Everything else, it's a great place to train. It keeps us ready. Yeah, it's a lot to think about, isn't it?
There's so many things that my mind is just piecing together when I came into this thing, not knowing much, and now all of a sudden I've got so much information. I'm trying to restructure my understanding of this thing. Yeah. That's a big entity out there doing a lot of things.
It is, and I think, too, a lot of questions kind of come up, and we've talked about this a lot, but, you know, why does Idaho care? Why does Boise care about the Idaho Air National Guard? And I mentioned earlier, we do an economic study every couple of years. The last one we did in fiscal year 2020, and it takes about a year to do, so we just got this thing at the end of last year. And it was done by Dr. Reading, who is BSU, is an economist. And our annual contribution to the local economy in Idaho is $658 million. So that's direct, indirect, and induced cost. You think, holy cow, $658 million. What are you people doing out there? But that's all the pay. Here's another interesting fact. So that includes pay, construction, all the other units coming in, fuel, all these things that Boise is getting the benefit of, and really the state of Idaho. And that's my second point. So we have our Idaho or our tax revenue. So it's you can call it return on investment or the state makes off of taxes. So the state from the general fund puts in $2 million into the Idaho National Guard. So we have some state contractors and employees. But the tax revenue from the Idaho National Guard is $30 million a year. So $7 million is what the general fund puts in. So we're right around $23 million that the state makes off taxes that they're not putting into the National Guard. So it's a huge benefit for Idaho.
So besides doing podcasts and employing people like Taylor over here, what are you doing for community outreach as far as like communication? Because not to say that there are opportunities, but obviously I needed some education. But what else do you guys do for public outreach?
Yeah, so we were, I think, on a roll for a while, and Taylor was with us, and then COVID hit. So we had a really good program. We were hitting Rotary Clubs. We were going to schools. We were really putting the word out. The biggest thing, I think, that we did was we had the open house in 2017.
What is an open house?
It was the air show.
Yeah.
Oh.
Now, we don't call it air show because it was Army and air.
Right, but
so we showcased.
For those listening, there were really cool planes here flying.
Lots of cool airplanes. Yeah. We had cool tanks, a big firepower demo. We had airmen, soldiers around, and that was our biggest one. How many we have, Taylor? Like 120,000, 130,000?
I think so, yeah.
2 days.
Wow.
Yeah, we were supposed to do that last fall, last August. But just looking at COVID and if that made sense, we had to make the call early, right around the spring of 2021. I don't think we're going to be able to pull this thing off. And talked to Mary McLean and her staff and made the decision to cancel it. But then we're going to do it in 2023, excuse me. Mm. That's our next one. But that's our biggest one where people can actually come out and maybe not touch airplanes, but they can look at airplanes, get real close to them. But they can climb on tanks, they climb on Bradleys, and they say, yeah, this is what my military is doing.
But the base is open for tours, correct? Because I feel like I took a couple of young men's groups out there to tour some of the planes out there at one point.
Yeah, and Taylor can
maybe
talk
that's
to that.
Kind of shut
yeah,
down.
Yeah, there's a lot of like corporations can come out and groups, and those are all organized through the public affairs departments that are out on the base. But yeah, that's fairly easy to do. We also have the Honorary Commander Program, which basically we have leaders in the community in of various sorts that are paired up with a shop on the base. And it's kind of this symbiotic relationship where the individuals in that shop can learn skills and learn resources and get closer to their community through that honorary commander. And in turn, the honorary commander becomes an advocate for the Guard and can help tell the story of the Guard to the community so that people understand more about what we do. So it's not such a mystery. You mentioned before that it's kind of a mystery out there.
Yeah.
So we kind of use our honorary commanders as a way to help tell the story.
That's cool. Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. We've covered a ton of ground today, and I feel like we've been a little bit scattershot, but I'm having fun. I don't know about you, too.
Yeah.
What have we missed? General, when you're thinking about like a message that you wish, if there were something that you could drive home to the community to understand, what comes to your mind?
I think I would ask them to think of the value of the National Guard. Without going to rabbit hole, we had a good discussion about F-35s coming to the Idaho Air National Guard. And it is a noisy airplane. I'm not going to tell you it's not. But when you think about what that brings to our community and who do you want for your neighbors, who do you want for your employees, our airmen and soldiers that are working on the most modern equipment and have the best training, they are the people that you want to have for your next door neighbor. They're the ones that you want to have in your society. And so I would ask them when we talk about these missions, because they'll be public, because it's we are citizens and we're employees of the public, really. We get paid through taxes. We're going to have these public conversations. I would ask people to not just glom on one piece, but to take a look at that and say, hey, why would I want this? And then understand the true nature of what we're trying to do. Because Idaho is an amazing place to live. We've got amazing leadership. We have just an amazing environment. And we're good stewards of all of those things. So that's what I would ask is that, hey, have the whole conversation.
I like that. I think that that's an important lesson in a lot of stuff, that it's more than just the one thing that you're thinking. The benefit is not just noise or no noise. The benefit is other things.
Absolutely.
What's the benefit of having these people, the economy benefited from it? It's a lot more nuanced than just one thing.
Yeah, I think so. And you're right. That's life.
Yeah. Taylor, how about you? Closing thoughts.
Yeah, I would just say ask questions. Now, if you know someone who's in the Guard, don't approach it like a mystery. Don't approach it like, oh, we don't really know what they do and we don't really want to ask. Ask, because you might be so surprised at what they do. I mean, I don't know anyone who thought that you could just join the military and take pictures like I did. So ask about what they do, because you're going to learn a lot and it might inspire you to be an advocate for them.
Awesome. Well, thank you both. Thank you both for your service.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming and sharing some of your time here on the podcast. I learned a ton, and I know that everybody else is going to learn a lot too.
That's been awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, friends, goodbye.
The Boise Bubble Podcast is sponsored by Volkswagen of Boise. Interested in buying a Volkswagen in the Treasure Valley? Head to www.volkswagenofboise.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. This is the Boise Bubble Podcast. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a 5-star review. Follow us on Instagram at the Boise Bubble. And for more information about our community, follow @HelloMeridian. See you next time.